from St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. After losing a bid for the state Senate in 2016, Mark Boyko was hardly inactive. The Democratic official ran for and won a seat on the Kirkwood Board of Education, and last year he prevailed in a race to represent Missouri's 90th House District. Boyko joins us on Politically Speaking to give his take on how lawmakers are dealing with education policy and what it's like serving in the Democratic superminority. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
Let's go back to some of those policies, to that peace and prosperity that we had some 4 to 5 years ago.
Everywhere is Democratic country once this Democrat's been there.
There are a lot of things in Washington that are very bipartisan, including some bills that I've already gotten passed.
And I think it works best when you can see both sides, but you have to pick one, and I firmly align with the Republicans.
But certainly, I think if she's running against one of the crazy dudes, certainly it's going to be a lot easier.
But I'll take wisdom and age and a few missteps in oral to over somebody who has no substance.
I believe that you represent the party's values and you move forward, and that's what I have done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio's Statehouse and Politics reporter, Sarah Kellogg. Joining me in St. Louis, he is St. Louis Public Radio's political correspondent,
Jason Rosenbaum.
And across from me in Jefferson City, he is the representative for the 90th District in the Missouri House,
Mark Boyko.
Thank you so much for joining us on the show. I know it's not your first time on the show, but it's been apparently, according to Jason's notes, more than 8 years since you were last on the show when you were running for the 15th senatorial district as a Democrat. What have you been up to since 2016?
Yeah, I'm due for another checkup. I have been lawyering like I have been. I do ERISA class action litigation. So basically, I represent workers and retirees who are having their retirement plans stolen by their employer or Wall Street. Bring cases to defend them. I also went and got myself elected to the Kirkwood School Board in 2019, pre-COVID, and then got to run that journey. And that race is almost complete. I'll be ending my second term there in April.
How did your tenure as a member of the Kirkwood Board of Education prepare you for coming to the Missouri House, if at all?
Look, I think that there's a I don't want to describe this as a higher office. This is a lateral move, certainly geographically, and also, I think in terms of responsibility too. But it's a great area to learn just some of the ins and outs of things like the Sunshine Law and just dealing with people in a legislative process. That's just sort of somewhat akin to what we see in Jefferson City.
You had the fortune of being elected to the school board in 2019, a year before the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm interested to hear how overseeing the district during 2020 and 21 gave you perspective on the role of government during a crisis.
Yeah, I think what was a real opportunity that we saw in the very early days of the pandemic was to say, what is our goal here? What are we trying to prioritize? It's almost a question of who is the client, right? Who are we trying to benefit the most? And we sat down and we said, look, the best thing for kids is to be in a classroom learning. And so we're going to do whatever it takes to maximize the amount of time that our students are in a classroom learning. But maximizing that amount of time doesn't mean doing so unsafely. Obviously, if you're going to have a COVID outbreak, that's going to bring the amount of time you can be in the room to zero. And so it's managing that in a way that, is holistic and make sure that our kids are getting what they need. And I think the evidence has borne out that our district was able to weather COVID, considering how huge of a disruption that was and unprecedented, really. You'd have to go back more than a century to find a disruption in education that's at all parallel to it. We've been able to weather it pretty well, and we've gotten to a point where our kids are testing better than they were before the pandemic.
Representative Barbara Pfeiffer decided to run for Secretary of State, opening up the seat that takes in portions of St. Louis County. What made you want to try again, since you were unsuccessful in 2016, and run for the Missouri House in 2024?
Yeah, Representative Pfeiffer met with me when she was planning her statewide race and asked if this would be something I'd be interested in. It's an opportunity here. You know, really what gets me out of bed in the morning is trying to represent and further the mission of people who are actually working in our economy to build it and what I fight against both professionally and here now in Jefferson City is this erosion of the benefit of our economy's productivity to the point where workers are getting less and capital, people who are already rich, are getting more. And I don't mean to sound that, like I'm coming at it from a class warfare sort of perspective. I want everyone to be rich. Don't get me wrong. But at the same time, we have so many opportunities for people and companies to come in and siphon off resources that should be going to the people who are, on the ground working to build our economy. And making sure that those people get what they deserve is a primary driver for me. And I saw this as an opportunity to productively further that goal in addition to keeping my legal practice.
With the caveat that this House district changed since 2016 because of redistricting, why do you think Kirkwood and the general vicinity has shifted from being relatively even from a partisan standpoint to being pretty solidly Democratic?
I think the move of the Republican Party has been the predominant reason why my district has shifted. When I knock on doors, there's plenty of people who respond. And I knocked on a lot of Republican doors. I did not, just focus on the Democrats, even though I could have gotten elected here only on Democratic votes. But it was intentional to go and talk to everybody. And when you talk to Republicans on the doors in Kirkwood, more often than not, what you get is, well, I used to consider myself a Republican. I used to be a Republican. But what's going on in Washington, D.C. is crazy. Those are their words, not my words. It's really been a case of the Republican Party, especially at the top of the ticket, has moved away from the limited government roots that the Kirkwood Republicans, still support.
Now that you've had more than a month to settle into the House, what are your impressions of serving in the supermajority?
On a day like today, it's not a lot of fun to be pressing the no button a lot, right? That's just the way it is. That's the nature of our democracy. And I knew that going in, that there were going to be days like today and probably days even worse to come. But it is, there are opportunities here. And I've been actually, to the extent I've been surprised by what's been going on in Jefferson City and my ability to get things done, I've been surprised by the things we've been able to accomplish as a freshman minority member in the legislature.
For our listeners, we're recording this on Thursday, February 20th. So if you want to go over some of the bills that you voted no on today, just to kind of give them a context.
Yeah. So we voted to shorten the statute of limitations for personal injury claims from 5 years to 2 years, which creates a number of problems. And I've actually, while I'm currently an attorney on the plaintiff's side, I've actually defended in my career personal injury cases. So I understand that. But it's not going to help Missourians to have a statute of limitations that short. And it's actually going to lead, in my opinion, to more lawsuits being filed, bad lawsuits being filed that shouldn't be filed in the first place, because a lawyer has to get it on file before the statute is blown. We've also voted to give Monsanto a free pass, frankly, for Roundup. And we voted to allow the state government to take control of the St. Louis police force. And that's a bill that, if that was the only issue, we could have a nice debate about it, and maybe we will later on the show. I don't know. But that was also loaded with a lot of other issues with it, raising criminal penalties for situations where just simply attending a gathering of people could lead to serious felony charges against you if the prosecutor was so inclined.
Yeah, we're going to get into that bill a little later. But another issue that popped up this week was legislation banning diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives in state government that also passed today. You spoke up on this, saying that it was likely irrelevant given Governor Mike Kehoe's executive order this week on the matter. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, and this is a bill that doesn't help people. This is one of the things I learned, frankly, on the Kirkwood School Board from our lived experience. And I comment on this on the House floor earlier in the week. We focused as a school district on building belonging, especially among our staff, but also among our students. But what we found was, in light of us taking a year and kind of hitting the pause button and being really intentional about belonging, we had a dramatic reduction in turnover and an improvement people wanted to work for us, right? And so what we saw was in the classroom and in the hallways an improvement as a result of wanting to focus on belonging. And the bill that, you know, I had to hit no on again today is one that takes a step back from that and says, motivated by what you hear in the national media rather than based on facts, we're going to really just send a whistle to our base and say that we're fighting DEI, which has been built into a boogeyman by certain parts of the media.
Governor Kehoe told us that his executive order would not preclude agencies from providing training to employees about minority communities they serve. And that's often what agencies like the Department of Social Services have done, since they often interact the most with disadvantaged minority groups. Is it possible that any quote-unquote diversity, equity, and inclusion ban may not actually have as much tangible impact on state government as the proponents say it might?
Yeah, that's possible. That's certainly possible that on the ground it wouldn't, but it's also at least as likely, I would say, that what it will do is cause department heads to, you know, certainly think twice before doing anything that's related to one of these topics, and using it as an excuse if they don't think that training is appropriate or something's got to get cut, which, you know, obviously we're in a time of tight budgets. If something's got to get cut and you think that you might get questioned by the government or by the governor or by the legislature for having a program like this, and next year in your budget, if they're looking to cut something, they're going to look to cut your budget because you included something that has the word diversity, equity, inclusion, or belonging in the title of it. You know, certainly there's going to be a chilling effect on your willingness to have that show up in your budgets.
It's obviously still early, but it does seem that Republicans are less divided than they were in previous years. And I can define division as like interpersonal relationships in the Senate or divisions between the House and the Senate. I understand that this is like your first 2 months here and you probably didn't witness that, you know, firsthand. But is that making things harder for the Democratic caucus to push back on things that you oppose?
Yeah, I mean, I'd have a hard time speaking to past years. I've certainly followed the news in the past, but I haven't been consistently in the building here in the Capitol in past years. So I can't really speak to whether it's worse now or better now compared to how it was. But certainly, if we are functioning as one of three political parties instead of one of, and each party has a third of the House or the Senate, that's a little bit easier than if we're functioning as one of two parties and we still only have a third of the House.
Shifting to education, Governor Kehoe is not fully funding the K-12 foundation formula, though he is pointing out that schools are getting more money than last year. He says this is part of the reality of leading budgetary times. What is your reaction to this?
It's the reality of a conscious choice to cut taxes on the rich. That's why education is getting cut. And there's a misconception among some members of the majority that education is somehow hurting their party. But I think that's really just a cover for the idea that they want to allow profit-seeking entities to come into the education field, just like we see in the medical field and other practices.
The foundation formula is incredibly complicated and would probably require an entire show to explain everything about it. But can you talk a little bit about the formula, how it affects schools, say, in Kirkwood that may already have a strong tax base?
Yeah, so you get a little bit torn here when you're talking about the actual details of the formula, because there's certainly room to improve how resources are allocated between districts across the state. At the end of the day, there's really two questions, though. One of them is sort of one school district versus another school district, who should get how much money. But the bigger question, and the one that has been getting attacked lately, is just the how much money as a society should our state government be spending on education, as opposed to either defunding education or pushing that onto property owners to be paying those taxes.
Kehoe has said he wants to start discussions about rewriting the formula, which is, you know, he's acknowledged will likely produce a swarm of controversy. What do you think about this idea?
If we're going to have a serious conversation about whether the formula system, whether the, again, the allocation between school districts is right for the modern age or not, I'm more than open to those sorts of conversations. And again, to your earlier question, in a district like Kirkwood, we receive relatively less in state funding because we have a strong property tax base that is able to, willing and able to support the district to the extent that we need.
Speaking after the State of the State address, Democratic Minority Leader in the House, Ashley Awney, said pretty much about the foundation formula, the fact that Republicans might want to redo the foundation formula because it is eventually giving money to schools. It's giving too much money. And so thoughts on kind of the fact that it is coming at a time where a reevaluation of the formula is coming, where more money is coming to schools in recent years than maybe it had prior.
I think we need to focus on a more historical look at this. And if you go back to back in the early days of Republicans controlling the legislature here a generation ago, you compare the extent to which our economy was being spent on education, on public education, and you compare that to today, we're shorting education already, and this is before the governor wants to short it further by over $1 billion. And that's one of those numbers that it's hard to fathom exactly what that means. But if you break it down by how many classrooms there are in the state of Missouri, it's $30,000 per classroom that we are underfunding compared to what we were doing a generation ago. And so to attack public education and saying the results aren't as good as they were a generation ago, and therefore we need to cut more funding from education, doesn't make any sense. The results aren't what they were a generation ago because we're underfunding from a generation ago. And if you find yourself in a hole, the first rule is to stop digging, and we got to learn to stop doing that.
One of the other things Kehoe proposed in his budget was providing $50 million in state money to bolster what's known as education savings accounts. In a nutshell, it's a tax credit that is given to donors of designated scholarships that can be used for private schools or to go from one public school to another. What do you think of the governor's budgetary proposal here?
There's not a state where this has been successful. And what we see is you either end up with a situation like, I believe, Arizona, where it just blows a complete hole in the budget, or you end up with a situation like a lot of other states where the private schools, the people going to boroughs, or boroughs itself raises their tuition. If you're giving everybody an $8,000 credit, they'll raise their tuition by $8,000, and they'll be happy to pocket those $8,000. That's effectively it's a transfer from general revenue to people who are already rich.
There is some possibility that this idea could face pushback from Republicans, particularly in more rural legislative districts. Sarah, if I'm not mistaken, I think the expansion for ESA in that big education bill last year barely passed the House. Is that correct?
It got the exact number it needed to pass the House last year. Yes, they were whipping votes pretty. You could see them moving around last year for sure.
They probably needed an actual whip in order to get to 82 votes. Is this something that may not be a foregone conclusion, given that Republicans are not lockstep on ESAs?
That's right. I think they realize that these are practices, whether it's school choice or ESAs, that are going to kill a lot of their districts. The exurbs, you know, where you have parents who work in Clayton, right? And maybe they live out in a district that doesn't have the sorts of resources that a Clayton school district spends on a student, right? Those are the people who are going to pull their kids out of those schools, and it's going to have a negative effect on those districts.
We've talked a lot about what Republicans want from education. What would you like to see in terms of education policy during your time in the legislature?
Look, I think we need to do a better job of understanding and trusting that the teachers in the classrooms across Missouri are doing the best job they possibly can to educate the students with what they have. The principals and administrators, the same thing. I don't think people fully appreciate how competitive that marketplace is. You know, among superintendents, it's increasingly, it's like college coaches of football and basketball, right? Like there is a huge pressure to have test results that are positive and indicate that you're quote unquote winning. And if those results don't materialize, we will go to the marketplace and find another person to lead our team, right? And so there's really not this agency problem that it seems like a lot of legislation over the last 10 years has been trying to fix, a problem that doesn't exist, of trying to motivate school districts to compete against each other when everyone involved in education is doing the best that they can.
We need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. And we're back on Politically Speaking. Our guest today is Representative Mark Boyko, who is the representative for the 90th District in the Missouri House. So let's talk about some of the other major things happening in the legislature. One is a push from both the governor and the legislature to have a gubernatorial board oversee the St. Louis Police Department that actually passed the House today. What do you think of this idea?
Yeah, and this is something where I was it was an easier no vote for me today because, like I mentioned before, that bill was loaded with some other provisions that would create, you know, huge felony crimes for doing simple protesting. And so that's one of the that made this an easy decision for me today. In terms of what's actually best for St. Louis City, I'm not convinced that having a governor be appointing a board, especially when that governor is, let's face it, not elected by or approved by a majority of St. Louis City residents, makes sense. And if we look at the Kansas City example, you know, Kansas City this year, crime is up, and in St. Louis, crime is down. And that's not to say crime is solved. You know, there's no mission accomplished banner certainly going around in St. Louis City. And I understand the situation there. And the people in my district and myself, we travel into St. Louis City, are keenly aware of the crime issues involved there and would love to solve it. But again, to the point of who's in a better position to solve that, I think that the residents of St. Louis City are more motivated to come up with a good solution to that problem than the governor in Jefferson City.
St. Louis County, the county that you partially represent, has a board of police commissioners appointed by the county executive. And I'm not saying it's a perfect system, and I'm not saying that there is no political interference, because in the past there have been accusations that the county executive has told the board to fire, like, a police chief, for instance. But I would argue the St. Louis County Police Department is generally seen as a well-functioning law enforcement agency. Is it possible that maybe a compromise here is just saying that the city would have to adopt a similar board of police commissioners to the county, and the mayor would appoint the members as opposed to the governor?
Yeah, I think that would be an opportunity for a good conversation. I think there are plenty of opportunities for people who are genuinely interested in reducing crime in St. Louis City to come around a table and come up with solutions that make sense for the state and for St. Louis City itself.
If state control isn't the answer, what would you like to see happen to improve public safety in the St. Louis region?
I don't know that there's I'm coming at this obviously from a perspective of a tax lawyer in Kirkwood, who doesn't have to, you know, we've got a great police force here. Obviously, our citizens are, and the people I represent, are concerned about crime, but we also understand that we live in an area that is largely not directly touched by the sorts of crime that we see in St. Louis City. It's important to get that under control. Obviously, the economic success of the region and probably the whole state is dependent on having a better perception of public, a better perception of safety in the region. But at the same time, I certainly don't want to pretend to be the expert on what the right answer is to achieve that, but I think that people who are closer to the ground, and that includes the police forces and the people who are keeping us safe, are integral to coming up with that solution.
You mentioned other provisions in this legislation. It actually ends up being a pretty big bill, pretty early for a bill this big. Normally, you see these kind of more in April rather than February. But there was definitely one on the issue of rioting. It changes the definition. I'm assuming that was what you talked about earlier as far as group gathering. I want you to talk me through this and our listeners through kind of the changes of this.
Yeah, and I want to it is a huge bill, and I won't pretend to you know, have a huge level of expertise on every part of it. But at the same time, and again, I don't want to bring national politics too much into it, but at the same time, what it would mean is essentially if you were in the Capitol Mall on January 6th, you could be charged with a Class A or Class B felony if the equivalent thing happened, let's say in St. Louis, right? Just because some members of the group that you were with happened to commit a crime or they were involved in the destruction of property, you would be given this rioting charge just because you were in the vicinity.
Another change is that it requires, in instances where, you know, maybe someone is arrested, if the law enforcement finds out the immigration status of said person, they have to then report it, if you want to get into that also as well. Those feel like kind of the two bigger pieces of this bill in addition to the police change.
Yeah, and like I said, some of these provisions are put in order to feed sort of a narrative that is false, frankly, that Democrats are somehow lawless or anti-police or anti-law and order, and that's not at all the case. But there's sort of these, once you mention immigration in today's environment, you sort of politicize things so that you can come up with a talking point.
Another issue item that is likely to come up this year is an effort to repeal or replace Amendment 3. Abortions just resumed in the Show Me State thanks to a decision to strike down licensing requirements. Do you think this may accelerate efforts to put a repeal replace measure on the 2026 ballot, or, you know, it could be even earlier if Governor Kehoe decides to issue an election?
Yeah, I think that this is an issue that obviously Missourians have spoken. It was clear. They knew what they were voting for. And obviously, if you were following the advertisements on the no side immediately prior to the election, the bill was being misportrayed in that direction. And so the fact that Missourians have spoken, that should be the end of it, right? We would like to think that we live in a democracy and we can put this issue to rest. At the same time, it's an issue where if you're fighting in a Republican primary, it's still a reality that you've got to be seen as fighting to repeal Amendment 3. And so it'll be interesting to see if it comes up or not. This session, I'd be surprised if it did not come to the floor, though.
I was watching a press conference primarily of state senators talking about how they plan to pursue some sort of redo on Amendment 3. And Senator Adam Schnelting of St. Charles County specifically cited ads that insinuated that miscarriage care wasn't available under the abortion ban as the reason why he felt voters were fooled. What do you think of that? Because I've heard that argument a lot. I'm not saying I endorse that argument, but you're probably going to hear that a lot when they try to put something else on the floor.
Yeah, I mean, there were also ads that insinuated that a yes vote meant that a school could change the gender of your child without your knowledge once you send them to school on Monday. So, you know, we can play those sorts of arguments, but that's at least as true, if not, you know, more so on the other side. We could also play that, if the president in a campaign says he's going to lower the price of eggs on day one and he doesn't do it, do we have a recall election at that point, right? And I think the answer to that has to be no.
If abortion is, again, on the ballot, and I would assume it would be in 2026, it will be during the halfway point of Donald Trump's lame duck presidency. Based on historical precedent, Democrats should have the advantage in this type of election. That certainly what happened in 2014 and in 2006. Is it possible how do you think that could shape any effort to repeal or replace Amendment 3?
Yeah, it's going to be tricky for them to find an election that's coming up where it makes sense for them to put this on the ballot and expect any sort of different result. And I think that you hit the nail on the head that the Trump midterm election is not going to go well for them. At least historically, there's no reason to think that it will. And so certainly November is not going to be the right answer. And I think that if you look at the turnout in the August primaries in the midterm of Trump's first term, you'd also realize that that's not going to be a great election for them to put it out.
One thing we didn't see in 2024 was any tangible coattail effect for Missouri Democrats. They lost badly for all the races for statewide office. They remain the same in terms of their levels in the Missouri General Assembly. Do you think this a similar scenario could happen in 2026, where there could be an abortion measure on the ballot trying to repeal Amendment 3? There's a lot of turnout to try to defeat it, but it doesn't end up helping your party in any tangible way, especially in the legislature.
I think that the Democrats are learning some lessons from the last couple elections, and they're painful lessons, but I think we're realizing we got to be better at customer service, right? And we have to view the voter as the customer, and I hope that some of the lessons that have been learned are that it's not a winning strategy to portray to your customer that you're smarter than they are, or that you have, or the things that they believe, you know, aren't important, and the things that you believe are more important than that. I go back to my mother. She was a teacher, but also had a side hustle at some point selling clothing at the old famous bar in Fairview Heights. And, you know, someone comes up to them with an article of clothing they want to purchase. And, of course, she's going to say, yeah, that looks great on you. Let me see if I can, you know, find something else to complement that. And she got paid on a commission, and she did a very good job of that, right? And I think that Democrats are realizing that perhaps the winning strategy to win over customers isn't to say, well, no, that doesn't fit you. You shouldn't be wearing that color. We just got to do a better job of just logically embracing the customer, you know, where they are, and making sure that they understand we want them to succeed. We want every Missourian to become rich. We want them to have food that they can afford. We want them to have houses that they can afford. We want them to have a quality education that they can afford, that they can send their kids to college. We want them to find rewarding work, and we want them to be able to support their families.
Well, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much, Representative Boyko, for being on the show. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is owned by the University of Missouri, St. Louis. You can find all of our coverage on stlpr.org. And Representative Boyko, where can people find you on the internet where you want to be found?
Thanks for having me on. My website is just markboyko.com. And I'm also can be found on Facebook.
All right. Until next time. So long.
Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio, this is Politically Speaking.